1290 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Daria Albinger. For the first time since 2013, Macy's 4th of July fireworks lit up the sky over New York City's Hudson River with 60,000 shells and 30 colors. For the few years before it, it was held on the East River between Manhattan and Brooklyn. Outside the White House for the Capitol 4th fireworks, a woman shouted to President Biden, "Keep up the fight," and he responded,
"You got me, man. I'm not going anywhere."
Sources say Mr. Biden told the Democratic governors he met with last night that he needs more sleep and that he does not want to schedule events after 8 p.m. It looks like there's going to be a change of power in the U.K. as the Labour Party appears headed for a landslide victory in the parliamentary election. That means centre-left leader Keir Starmer will likely be the next prime minister. A fireworks technician was injured during an accidental discharge during the Jax Fest in Jacksonville. This is ABC News.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. You can find it anywhere at the WGBW website, wgbw.fm.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. President Biden tells Civic Media's Earl Ingram that Donald Trump wants to undo all he's done for black Americans.
I'm sorry to get so worked up, but he is just, he's done terrible things to the community, and he has about as much interest and concern for black and minority communities as the man in the moon does.
Biden says he's appointed black leaders to high positions in government and fostered a boom in black-owned businesses. Biden campaigns in Madison Friday. The leader of the Universities of Wisconsin's second biggest school is stepping down. UW-Milwaukee Chancellor Mark Mone says he plans to return to his faculty position in UWM's business school next spring. Mone was chancellor for 10 years. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Hi, this is Jim Schmidt, your former mayor of Green Bay. You know, I've always cared about local issues. I still do. Join me on my new show, Lean Local, here on WGBW. I'll interview community leaders and elected officials, discuss the economy and development projects, and we'll talk about the future of education here in Greater Green Bay. As they say, all politics is local. So join me for Lean Local, Sunday at 1 p.m. on the Talk of Green Bay, 97.9 WGBW.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Going to start today off with a couple of emails, of which I asked for you to send me angry emails, and you did not disappoint. Ronnie in California sent me this email, said, "Rick, you know I love you, you know I support you in the show. You know I'm on Team Working Class and have written numerous times with praise, but how can you now, after the last 3 years, allow people to come on your show calling for our president to step aside? How can you be questioning Biden's ability given what he has accomplished?" And look, it's difficult because for the past 3 years, I have been Joe Biden's biggest fan. I have said from the beginning, he's moving us away from neoliberalism, looking at reshoring manufacturing. We've got an industrial policy for the first time in my life, talking about, and getting money to reinvest in our country and build our infrastructure and doing a lot of great stuff. His NLRB, his Department of Labor, all of those people, his administration is what I want. It's my fantasy administration. But my problem is, I fear after Thursday's debate performance that you're going to have a problem getting him elected. And that for me is a problem. And I think back to RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She knew a couple years before she passed, she was not doing well. And she could have stepped aside sooner. could have ensured that her seat was filled by Obama early enough that McConnell would have had no chance to steal that seat. And what did we end up with? We ended up with her deciding by default, and we ended up with Neil Gorsuch. My thought process is we have to win. We have to ensure that we hold on to the White House, we hold on to power, and do the things that Biden is doing. Keep following that path. Look, I'm not on the campaign. I don't know what state Joe Biden is in, but what I saw is a struggle for me. But here's the thing. I do find it interesting that the debate happened when it did, the earliest in my lifetime a presidential debate. Why did they choose well before the convention? Well before the convention. Could it be they're thinking, don't know if he's going to do well. Give us some time to correct course. Part of me thinks that. Lewis in New York said he was disappointed because what it sounds like is typical panic analysis. And he suggested that, if Biden's cognitive skills are going to be front and center, that we go after Trump's. And look, understand, we've been doing that. The right doesn't care. The red hats don't care. The ink has bled into the brain or whatever's there. They don't care what Trump does. Did you not pay attention to 2015, 2016? They don't care. But what they saw a guy who was message disciplined and, for Trump, extremely restrained. And what they saw is they saw Joe Biden who couldn't deliver the punchline. And for me, that's a huge problem. If you can't deliver the punchline of the incredible work that you have done, we have a problem. Lewis also says, the Lincoln Project or some other organizations need to come out with video snippets of Trump. And yeah, they've done that. In fact, the Lincoln Project, their people are saying Joe's going to be a one-term president, either by choice or they don't think he's going to win. And look, we can, as Lewis says, remind people of the 4 years of misery under Trump. People's memories are very short-term. And look, the economy, Joe's one of his strongest things. The right has successfully convinced people is bad. We're not fighting a game or a war or a battle of normal political fights. We are fighting for the heart and soul of this nation. The Heritage Foundation's president, this guy Kevin Roberts, was on a podcast, and he said, "We are in the process of the second American Revolution, which will remain bloodless if the left allows it." Think about that. Well, I don't know what the second revolution is and what they're fighting for. I can guess because they keep telling us the original intent, which means women, you don't get to vote. Never mind abortion. You don't get to vote. You don't get to own anything. You're going back to the kitchen. Minorities, you're 3/5 of a person. You're going back to the fields. The original intent, think about it. They've been telling us this for decades. No government intervention, which means no labor laws, no consumer laws, no laws to protect average everyday people. This is going to be about the wealth class and everybody else. And this is one of those moments where you go, even if right now you're donning the red hat, you have to be thinking in the back of your mind, when will I not be pure enough? What happens if I disagree with something, anything? Maybe we want women to vote. Well, you're not sufficiently loyal. Because if you haven't been paying attention, the Heritage Foundation and their Project 2025, they are literally going to weaponize government in all the ways that they claim Biden is doing. Which is kind of cute when they think, look how incompetent Sleepy Joe is, but he's weaponizing government. They're actually in the process of doing that. They're going to make patronage great again. And they're telling us, they're not lying. They're telling us what they're going to do. They're going to fire all the bureaucrats in government and they're going to replace them with great loyalists. But here's the problem. And here's what my red hat friends need to know. Trump has proven to us time and time again that loyalty is a one-way street. And the question you have to ask yourself is, how long before they come for you? I think about the old Pastor Neil Moeller poem where he wrote, first they came for the socialists and I said nothing. because I wasn't a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I said nothing because I wasn't a trade unionist. And then they came for the Jews, and go all down the line. They came for. By the time they came for me, he said, there was no one left to speak up. Right now is the time to save the heart and soul of this country. What we're watching right before our very eyes is a Supreme Court that's repealing everything that we view as the norm. That safety and security that we as workers, consumers, citizens, that we've taken for granted for too long, they are in the process of completely undoing. There is no such thing anymore as decided law with this Supreme Court. That is the reality. So it doesn't matter if you're donning the red hat today. Eventually, they're going to come for you. So the question becomes, as this second revolution is being fought, which side are you on? And this November, we're going to have an opportunity to decide that, whether it is Joe Biden against Donald Trump or it's someone else that Biden suggests we move towards. That's going to be the reality. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Gotta tell you, I can't get that quote out of my head. You stop and you think about what Kevin Roberts, the head of the Heritage Foundation, is saying on this podcast. We're in the process of the second American Revolution, which will remain bloodless if the left allows it to be. I mean, there is so much in that statement. First, the question is, like I said, what are we fighting for? And then, if the left allows it, it will remain bloodless? I'll tell you, we're in the fight of our life for this country. And right now, before our very eyes, you're seeing the repeal of the 20th century by our Supreme Court, and not in a good way. And that's why I've asked my good friend Eric Fink to come talk with us. Eric's an associate professor of law at Elon Law School. Eric, thanks for taking time for us.
Always happy to be here, Rick. Thanks for having me.
So am I being hyperbolic when I'm going, look, the Supreme Court's repealing the 20th century, this idea of a second revolution going to take us back to the Antonin Scalia thought of the original intent of the Constitution and all that comes with that? Am I being hyperbolic when I think like this?
Not one bit. I'll give the right wing credit. For one thing, they make no secret of this. They say it in the open, and they're very clear that they want to repeal at least the 20th century and really the second half of the 19th century, you know, as well. They want to take us back to, you know, 1789 or 1806 or something. Yeah.
No, it's scary because, you know, we're seeing states across the country attacking child labor laws. You know, we're safe working conditions are under attack. And then this decision last Friday to undo Chevron. I mean, this is a game changer. This is a massive shift, especially for working people in this country. The pendulum is swinging way now to the side of corporate interest because of this one decision.
And that's an example of what I mean when I say they don't want to stop with the 20th century. They want to repeal the second half of the 19th, because that's when we got administrative law in this country, and we got, you know, with the Interstate Commerce Commission and all the various agencies that came afterwards. And the central idea there is Congress cannot, in a modern economy, sit and legislate precisely all the little details of how economic and social regulation is going to work. That it's impossible if you require Congress to do that. So instead, Congress designates an agency, and we hope that it will be staffed with experts, and they'll have the time and expertise to do that. And that's what the right wing hate, because if you can get rid of that, there won't be any effective regulation. And Chevron was the crowning jewel in that system in saying, we trust these agencies, we trust Congress when it gives them this authority, and we as courts should stay out of it for the most part, unless what the agency does is, you know, clearly wrong. And now that's off the table, and the next step is going to be more. They're not going to be content to get rid of Chevron. They're going to start saying that Congress can't delegate power to these agencies at all. They're going to start striking down some of these agencies as well.
Now, what I said is, you know, when that decision came down, is, you know, that whole balance of powers thing, because there's a cute little display at George W. Bush's presidential library. It's a triangle on like a central ball, and your job is to try and figure out how to balance that. We've now just put a giant boulder on the judicial side of that triangle.
Absolutely. They have decided that they're the super legislature, and they're going to micromanage every piece of law, every piece of legislation, and, you know, every piece of regulation.
So now,
as how they see fit.
So now, as a law professor, you've got to be looking at this as, and, you know, I've taught all these lawyers who are now out in the field doing their jobs. I've taught them this way. The game has now changed. I mean, the entire groundwork of the legal theory, I think, and again, you're the professor here, but it's got to be changed.
Well, this is a conversation that I've had with my colleagues, and I'm sure law professors around the country, not like, you know, we're the most oppressed group of people, but we've been talking about this a lot. Like, how do we do our jobs? Is there any point? Like, how do we teach students to be lawyers? Now, you know, there's all sorts of areas of law, like car crashes and things, you know, all sorts of stuff that isn't affected by this. But the really important kinds of law that are about, especially the role of government, civil rights and civil liberties, this is completely in limbo now. And nobody can figure out, you know, it's not just a matter of how do we think about it as academics and write articles. We're trying to, you know, my job is to train people to be lawyers, to represent people in court who have problems. And I'm not sure what to tell them at this point about what happens when your case gets to court. All bets are off.
Because here's the thing, and I remember John Roberts, you know, his confirmation. You know, the whole, I'm sure you saw it as well. You know, he believes in decided law and stare decisis. He's going to call balls and strikes and all of that. Doesn't this fundamentally shift what is decided law? I mean, you know, they overturned Janus, they overturned Roe, they've overturned Chevron. It seems like there is nothing sacred to this court.
That's right. I mean, it wasn't true, of course, when John Roberts said it. He didn't. I'm going to give him the credit of that he didn't believe it, right? Because if he really believed it, he'd have to be kind of stupid too. But yeah, this court couldn't care less about stare decisis. And they are not interested in calling acted this way, right? And said, oh, that pitch, you're not allowed to throw a forkball, you know, in the ninth inning. That's a new rule. People would go wild.
So let me ask you this, you know, as someone who keenly watches this stuff, I mean, you know, like I said, Janus went the way out the door, Roe went, now Chevron has gone. What should we be looking for of ground, you know, those first cases you teach, you know, first year law students as the bedrock of our legal system? Which of those goes next? I've been saying Lochner's probably going to be gone very soon. You know, what should we be paying attention to?
Well, that's one. And I know I've talked about this with you before, and you mentioned it. Lochner was the old rule that basically said that neither the states nor the federal Congress can pass laws like minimum wage and overtime or other protective legislation. And I think that is high on the agenda. I don't know if it's the next number one, but I suspect it's in the top five. I think a big one immediately, because we've been seeing it on a different plane, is all sorts of civil rights litigation. Okay, the 60s Civil Rights Act and even older established civil rights law, even the Reconstruction era. And I think that we're going to start to see an upending of that, or at least that's one of the big targets. And right now that's playing out with the attacks on DEI in universities and other stuff. And people may not be focusing because it means who cares what happens at Yale University. But that's the strategy. They do it in places that people aren't going to get up in arms about, but that's how they're using stare decisis. They're creating new precedent, and we'll get to the next precedent. The other one, all right, having struck down Roe, they're already talking about now going after birth control.
Yeah.
Okay. And allowing states to outlaw any kind of birth control. Okay. And with that, we'll go further. They're already talking about undoing, you know, marriage equality. They're already talking about undoing recognition for anti-discrimination against LGBT people. So all of those civil rights, civil liberties, very much in the bullseye on their target, and economic legislation. The labor board is another one. You know, there are these pending cases with Elon Musk and Starbucks, Amazon, trying to convince the courts that the NLRB is unconstitutional. It's ridiculous. It's something that was decided long time ago under President Roosevelt, but I won't be surprised. Labor law is my primary area. I'm very concerned that this court will find a way to either, at best, defang the NLRB in their opinion.
Even more than it already is.
Or toss the, right, make it even less powerful than it is, or throw the whole thing out and just declare the act unconstitutional.
Which is where I got to tell you, given what their history has been, this short period of history is, I think they just chucked the whole thing, because why not? They've already done it with Janus and Roe and now with Chevron. Yeah, why not?
And who's going to stop them? That's the problem. Who's going to stop them?
Right, exactly. And who's going to stop them? Mm-hmm. So now let's move fast forward to Monday. Then you go from Friday's horrible decision to Monday's decision. Before I put any words in your mouth, what do you think of Monday's decision in the Trump in the immunity case?
The simplest way I can say it is that it's completely wrong. The dissenter right. It's not coherent. The argument. It's most important. It's incredibly dangerous for democracy. This idea that because someone occupies the presidency, that anything they do in their supposedly that you can say is in their official capacity, that they can't be answerable for that in court is incredibly dangerous. I think that's the most important thing. The second most important thing is the nonsense originalism, supposed so-called originalism that gets them there. Yeah.
But isn't the originalism that the president's not a king?
Thank you, because this is what I was going to say. Look, why do we have the Constitution, right? If we had the Constitution in 1789, because in 1776 we had a revolution. Why do we have that? The Declaration of Independence is very clear. Most of the Declaration of Independence is this list of terrible things that the king did. He did this, he did that, he did the other. And part of that is he was a tyrant, right? This whole idea of immunity, sovereign immunity, it's the idea that the king is the delegate of the Almighty and therefore can do no wrong. Okay. Now, the modern concept of immunity doesn't necessarily say that he can do no wrong, but it's just wrong. And that seems to me it is. They made a choice to have a president that's answerable and to have divided government in different branches of government. Now they've said the judicial branch, you know, is powerless to address what the president does in his official capacity. And it's incredibly dangerous. And yeah, I don't think that goes to one of the things that's wrong with originalism, you know, is that how do you say that this was the original intent of the framers?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of writing in the Federalist Papers and all of that stuff where you can get some idea, but, you know, they had no idea that this country would grow as it has. The idea that we're going to have a document written back in 1776 and that that's going to move us into the 21st century seems, you know, well, short-sighted at best, ridiculous.
Yeah, that there are two issues with originalism, and that's the first one. The first one is, why is that the appropriate way for courts to interpret and apply the Constitution? Our Constitution is now approaching 250 years old. It's the oldest of any, you know, country in the world, I believe, at least written Constitution. This country and the world have fundamentally changed in ways that go directly to the things the Constitution addresses, the structure and workings, powers of government, civil rights and civil liberties. It's interesting that at least some of the founders, Thomas Jefferson, I don't remember the exact quote, but they were very clear. They were not interested in what they called perpetuities. They strongly opposed the idea that one generation should be able to bind future generations in various ways. And so it's very questionable whether there was a strong consensus that the Constitution should always and forever be interpreted the way they understood it. You know, the alternative view, which I think is more persuasive and more democratic, is we're setting up a general framework. Here's how it's going to work now in our context. And in future generations, they'll interpret it in light of their own context.
Yeah, the idea of a
not
living...
Not hard to do, but it's... makes more sense.
Yeah, the idea that I was that I learned about in government class, the Constitution's a living document. We can, the beauty of it is we can change it if things come up. You know, like for instance, you know, slavery. You know, considering slaves 3/5 of a person. I don't know that was the right thing to put in there, and we decided it wasn't. And and that's the beauty of it. We can go back and we can fix things.
And it's written. I mean, if you really read the Constitution. It's not written in very detail. It's not written like a like an instruction manual. It's written in very general terms to use a sort of like due process, okay, and equal protection. These are not self-defining terms. So the second problem with originalism, even if you believe that paying attention to what the original meaning or intent was, even if you believe that's relevant, the second and bigger problem I think for this court is how do you figure out what that was? Because they didn't, I mean, there's, we have the Federalist Papers, which is what a certain group of the founders thought. We have notes from and diaries and letters from others. One thing is we see they didn't agree, okay? But what this court has been doing recently in this idea where they talk about things being deeply rooted in our nation's history and traditions, they're just using garbage history. They're telling tales, tall tale history, that has no real basis in historical evidence. Serious historians don't think this is a valid kind of history. And what it is they're looking for a meaning that lines up with right-wing policy. Yeah. And then they tell a pretty story that shows how right-wing policy is what the founders, by coincidence, had in mind.
Well, no, this is, understand, I think you'll agree, this is what, you know, 50 years of the Heritage Foundation, this is what, you know, 50 years of the wealth class investing in think tank network and radio and television and all of the things that they've done.
And law schools and law professors and legal scholarship. You know, I can laugh. No, who reads law review articles? Nobody. But who reads them are law students. And the elite law students who become clerks for the Supreme Court judges and the appellate judges, and the judges read them. So you get these articles written. I mean, the gun cases are a lot like that, right? You give some guy money to write articles favoring the Heritage Foundations or whatever right-wing groups, you know, preferred interpretation. And then the court says, oh, look, this law professor, you know.
Yep, they've created their own incestuous pool of disinformation. And masterfully so. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because, you know, it's easy right now. Before we started, you asked, how am I doing? I said, I'm a little bit in despair because I'm looking at what's happened. I'm anticipating what's coming. And I don't see a way of stopping the Supreme Court from completely undoing the 20th century. And in your words, part of the 19th as well. Is there hope here? I know the country's been in peril before. We've had a civil war. We've had moments of strife. This could be historically just another, when we look back at it in the rearview mirror, but any hope here?
I think there has to be, because if I say there isn't, then, you know, like, how do people go on with their lives, right? So there has to be. But I think it's unrealistic to think that we can turn the ship around. right? And turn it back in a forward direction in one election cycle or two election cycles. The right wing got to the point where they have the power they have because they started in the early 60s, they started the aftermath of the Civil Rights Acts, and they started building and going through the institutions and staffing them and building up. It's a decades long project.
Yep.
And the left broadly, from liberals to the Democratic Socialist left, have to really engage in this kind of coherent long-term strategy. And that's hard to do. And it's hard to be patient because we have this immediate crisis. We've got elections all the time. But if we don't do it, all we're ever going to be doing is trying to put out fires with thimblefuls of water.
And that is the fear. Eric, I appreciate the thoughts, the time. As always, good stuff. Look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks, Rick. Always good to see you.
Eric Fink, Associate Professor of Law at Elon Law School. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matt Nair on air.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Fireworks courtesy of Mother Nature in the overnight. Showers and thunderstorms and some locally heavy rainfall. Our overnight lows will drop to the lower to middle 60s. Shower and thunderstorm chances continue into Friday, highs reaching the upper 60s. It's 69 at our studios.
This July 4th, 97.9 FM and 1590 AM, WGBW would like us all to reflect on the words of John Dickinson. Then join hand in hand, brave Americans all. By uniting we stand, by dividing we fall. This message is made possible by Renez Group, offering assisted living, memory care, rehabilitation, and skilled nursing services. If you have a loved one in need, call 715-582-2200 for Renez Group in Peshtigo.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
One of the things I think we need to be talking about going forward as a country is, you know, how do we continue to build the country? How do we invest in the future? You know, how do we take on in this new era of the Supreme Court, you know, ruling that evidently corporations are going to be unregulated? I mean, we're going to have a really hard time overseeing what happens. You know, how do we start fighting back against some of this stuff? I've often said we need our own banking system. I would love to see community, you know, state-run banks like they have in North Dakota. But I came across this House bill, or this House resolution, for calling for a national infrastructure bank. House Resolution 4052. The National Infrastructure Bank Act of 2023, and thought, hey, maybe this is something we should be talking about. And that's why I've asked Alfeka Mertardi to come talk with us. She's an economist with the National Infrastructure Bank Coalition, their website, nibcoalition.com. Alfeka, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So walk me through what this is. What is the National Infrastructure Bank? We've heard about this stuff for the last couple of years. What is it? What would it do?
Okay. So we have a problem in Congress, namely that we don't have enough money in our budget. And we've tried to build infrastructure and do other things, but the budget simply is not big enough to accommodate all of this. So what the National Infrastructure Bank Act of 2023 will be to create a public bank that can lend for infrastructure projects all across the country. Again, why do we need one of those? Because we cannot adequately finance our infrastructure, either through the federal budget, state and local budgets, private capital money doesn't want to invest here. So the idea is this bank will top up all the spending we need, cover everything, and while it's rebuilding infrastructure, it'll reboot the American economy and dramatically improve the conditions for the American worker.
Yeah, I got to tell you, you know, I look at this and I ask myself, why don't we already have something like this? Because, look, infrastructure is something that we need in this country. Businesses need it. You know, citizens need it. Workers, consumers need this stuff. We need roads to get to work. You know, companies need roads to get products to market. We need this kind of stuff. And it's odd to me that we do it in such a weird hodgepodge kind of way. This seems to me, as I understand it, you know, maybe having something of a concerted effort to ensure that we do it maybe a better way.
That is why we need an institution, a full-time institution that only does this, that will complement the budget and pick up where the budget leaves off. Let's face it, we haven't invested in our infrastructure since the Eisenhower administration, which built the highway system. We had a little bit of it with the space program, but not too much. Everything's falling apart. Our infrastructure is 100 years old. Our traffic jams are horrendous. We have safety problems with people crossing bridges that really they shouldn't be driving over. We need our infrastructure. We need a dedicated source for investing in our infrastructure. This National Infrastructure Bank is it. We used to do this in our nation's past. We had four banks like this in our nation's past that built our country, our infrastructure and our country, starting after the American Revolutionary War. The idea was invented by Alexander Hamilton, our first Treasury Secretary, picked up by George Washington. Six presidents did banks like this. The last one was under FDR, started by Herbert Hoover, but under FDR. And this is how we get out of recessions, how we build infrastructure, how we hire up workers when we have a recession, and we need a long-term source of financing to do this. Other countries around the world have banks like this. They call it the American system, and they have permanent banks in place to finance their infrastructure.
Of course they call it the American system, because of course. But what do you say, Alfeka, to the person who goes, well, you're talking about socialism. This is a government-run bank.
Well, let that person say, do they want nobody regulating their meat when they go into the meat market and buy market and it's not safe meat? Do they want somebody watching to make sure that they're not spilling bad things in their neighborhood and destroying their water supplies? How much, you know, what is a reasonable input from the public, from public goods that we actually need? And we actually need these things. Everybody rides on the roads, and nobody says socialism, roads are socialism. No, they don't say that, because we need these public infrastructure projects to support our economy and support our workers and to make our quality of life better.
So explain to me, how do we do it now? I mean, the Biden administration, to their credit, got through $1.2 trillion in infrastructure improvements. Probably the first time in my lifetime we've seen this kind of investment, as you've pointed out. And I said at the time, nowhere near chunky enough, nowhere near big enough. The American Society of Civil Engineers said it at the time we needed about $4.8 trillion. So we got about a quarter of it. But how did we before? How did we patch our system? How did we fund things? How do communities get bridges and do this? How was it done before that?
Yeah, we built a lot of our infrastructure with a bank like this. For example, the previous bank, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, electrified all of rural America. 80% of rural America did not have electricity. They built dams like the Tennessee Valley Authority and the Colorado River System that not only delivered electricity, but delivered water to dry states. I mean, California would not have been a state without the contributions from banks like this. We know how to do this. It's absolutely important that we build this kind of infrastructure. It's a proven model, and we can do it today. The problem is you cannot do it through the budget alone. Okay. I mean, the bipartisan infrastructure law started out at $3.5 trillion under the Build Back Better. They couldn't figure out how to pay for it. They said, oh, no, we'll have to raise taxes. Oh, that won't do. We'll have to, you know, deficit finance. That won't do either. So it got smaller and smaller and smaller. And that's been the picture of trying to finance infrastructure through budgets. They just squeeze out the infrastructure in favor of paying for other things.
So then how's this different then? I mean, because you've got to have at least some seed money to start this bank, right?
Actually, that is another beauty of Alexander Hamilton. He discovered a way to use existing debt and repurpose it to capitalize a bank. This is the way it works. In the Revolutionary War, we acquired a lot, the states acquired a lot of debt to fight the war against the British. Hamilton came along and said, I will take all that debt up into the federal level, create the essence of the first treasury bonds. I will use part of it to capitalize a first bank of the United States, and then I'll use that capital to leverage and extend credit to build manufacturing capabilities in the United States. He built the first manufacturing centers in Paterson, New Jersey, and that started our Industrial Revolution. So it just shows you that you can repurpose something. The National Infrastructure Bank makes no calls on the federal budget. It doesn't raise spending, it doesn't raise the debt, but it repurposes old existing debt to capitalize a bank, extend credit, and provide financing for infrastructure projects, directs it towards infrastructure projects.
And it also sounds to me, I think back to, you know, during the war, people buying war bonds, but we've done this kind of stuff in the past. You could almost make infrastructure, you know, tie it to national security, and we're rebuilding for the future of security, right, for our children. You could make this a patriotic thing.
Can you imagine what it would happen if our electric grid went down? Right now, I live in Northern Virginia. Right now, they're trucking in electricity from West Virginia over new transmission lines that are coal powered, and they're using them to feed these new data centers. There's 300 new data centers in Northern Virginia, all working on artificial intelligence and things like that. They're just gobbling up electricity, and we might not have enough to turn on our light switches unless we do something really dramatic. Same thing happened in Texas when their grid went down. This summer's going to be the hottest one ever. We don't have enough grid capacity. We're really teetering on an electric failure that needs immediate attention. And there's no budget in any plan right now to work on our electric grid.
No, and it's an excellent point you make, because look, as we're moving towards electric vehicles and electrifying virtually everything, you know, we don't have the capacity at this moment. We've got aging infrastructure that's already failing. Imagine adding, you know, what is to come. And sadly, I don't think we're really capable as a political system right now of being proactive.
We need a central place to better plan our electricity. I mean, there's nothing socialistic about good planning. Everybody does good planning. Every company does good planning. We need to do better planning on our water supplies, on our city, urban transportation systems, on our electric grid. All of these things need good planning. If we do that, we can really improve not only the productivity of our economy, that is, trucks will move faster, it'll cost you less to turn on your light switch because it'll be much more efficiently delivered, but we can really, really help the American worker and boost up the technologies which are sadly falling behind. We're falling behind technologically on our competitors around the world.
No, I mean, Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist, who I'm not a huge fan of, but he had an incredible line. He said, look, he went from Beijing to LAX, and it was like going from the Jetsons to the Flintstones. You know, we have become the Flintstones in this because we don't have a centralized plan. One of the things I've given the Biden administration credit for is, you know, we're starting to think about having an industrial policy. We're doing something on building infrastructure, not near enough on either front, but we're moving in that direction. So it seems to me that there should and could be an opportunity and an appetite to do this. And look, I think what you're saying is great. What's the downside then? Because it all sounds like upside, but somebody ultimately has to pay for this stuff.
Well, but the trick is this: the secret sauce in a national infrastructure bank like this one is it is big enough to move the needle on the economy. For example, suppose you create a new all banks create money when they give out loans. Suppose this bank creates $1 in a new loan to loan for an infrastructure project that winds up creating through cascade effects through the economy, $3 new dollars of product coming out. So then what you're having is much more growth coming out than the original loan created. So you have much more capacity to repay back the loans. That's what happened when FDR electrified rural America. Everybody told him, don't lend to those people because they can't pay back the loans. They're just poor dirt farmers. What happened? Their farms improved in productivity. They bought milking machines, pumps, all these kinds of things. The farmers themselves went to work installing new electrical systems in their own houses and in regional areas. Their income went up. The whole thing boomed, and many of the co-ops are still in existence today that were created this way. It shows you that it really has a multiplier effect in the economy, and who benefits? Our small businesses and workers who get better paid jobs and lasting family sustaining wage paid jobs as well.
And this is, you know, for me, infrastructure is one of those things. It's like transit. You know, I think transit shouldn't be a for-profit thing. I think we the public needs to do it for the common good. Infrastructure, the same kind of thing, because the private interests aren't going to do it unless they can make money off of it, unless they can put up a cash box and get into your pocket every time you cross the street.
Right.
I'm in favor. You know, when they were complaining about the bridge to nowhere, I said, I'm in favor of a bridge to nowhere, because what happens when you build that bridge, it goes somewhere. And now you've got an opportunity to build and, like you said, grow and you know, as George Bush said, make the pie higher.
Right, right. Exactly.
So it seems to me that this is sane and rational. And the profits that would come back, correct me if I'm wrong, would then be reinjected into this bank, not into the pockets of investors.
Correct. Investors, for their part, will put in their treasuries to capitalize the bank. But then the bank's operations will be self-sustaining. It'll have plenty of money to do all of its operations and lending and pay its workers and so forth. It will have a whole fleet of engineers to help local municipalities that might not have the technical expertise to hire an engineer to, you know, to build out a road or plan or do whatever. And that'll all bring down costs for these borrowers. The projects will be very self-sustaining, and what we'll be seeing is so much more growth in small areas. The areas, for example, of the country that are really falling behind and dying are the rural areas. The farmers are moving; they can't make enough on their farms. They're moving to cities to get better paying jobs. We need to learn the lesson of the Chinese that has a large population and kept rural workers in rural areas and then farmed them back and forth to do these construction jobs and improve their pay and build out their areas. But that's one area that is falling behind, and the bank can really help them. Another is, you know, urban planning. We have, transportation systems and housing problems and, you know, aging water pipes, some of them even made out of wood. They're leaking all over the place. We have lead service lines everywhere. We need to have better organized planning for our infrastructure and how we live and improve our quality of living and make things safer for everybody.
No, and look, we desperately need to improve our infrastructure. You know, there was the one summer a couple of years ago where, you know, in Harrisburg, which is near where I live, it was like the sinkhole capital. It was swallowing up buses and all kinds of stuff because the pipes underneath the ground are 100 plus years old and they haven't replaced them. Now, you look at the fact that you've got this aging infrastructure that we just can't seem to get fixed. Sounds like a great idea. So let me ask you a last line of questioning. How come this isn't moving? This sounds like a great idea. It addresses a problem. I think universally, red hat, blue hat, hard hat, everybody in between agrees we need to do something about. Why can't we get something like this done?
So this is really a grassroots effort. We have our coalition has a grassroots campaign all across the country, and anybody, including your readers, can join this. They can go on to nibcoalition.com, sign up on the homepage for receiving updates so that we'll let them know about our events. They can join our network. They can call their members of Congress. They can show up at their state legislator offices and pester them to do resolutions, which will improve their local infrastructure. We are really making progress on this bill. We're now up to 37 co-sponsors among members of Congress. We're soon to introduce a Senate version of the bill. And a lot of folks in Congress recognize that the bipartisan infrastructure law was a great start, but it's just too small. Sure. And it's not having an impact. It's not being felt. And in particular, the areas where voters are really concerned is on housing prices. Rents are up 50 to 90%, depending on what city you're living in. Inflation is up. we haven't even seen the effect of what's going to happen in drought areas if we run out of food, if we don't produce food anymore because we don't have water for the food. So the worst might not even be here yet, but all of the voters are concerned about economic issues, and we just need to finally make a convincing argument to both the Democrats and the Republicans that we need a new policy, which is a little bit outside the box, although it's successful, been done before, works very well, to solve our infrastructure problems, and that will really reboost our American economy and, you know, move us forward. Otherwise, what is the alternative? We're going to go backwards. If you think it's Flintstones, it's going to be, you know, pre-Flintstones. So we really need it's this or nothing. The budget, the federal budget is in a huge deficit right now. We've got $35 trillion in debt. This year alone, the deficit is going to be $2 trillion. That means, what does that mean? No more money for infrastructure for the foreseeable future. Yeah. It's this or nothing.
I'm with you. And look, at the end of the day, we all agree, red hat, blue hat, that we need to build our infrastructure. As I've been saying, it's time to take those red hats and blue hats off, get the hard hat on, and rebuild this country. Alfeca Martardi, I appreciate you taking time for us. As this continues, I hope you'll come back and share more as you build the number of sponsors and push this towards the finish line.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate the time. Make sure you check out their website, nibcoalition.com. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Sound like a good idea? Because we need it. We need massive investments. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1966. That was the day that the Freedom of Information Act was signed by President Lyndon B. Johnson. The act required government agencies to respond to citizen requests for information. John Moss, a Democratic congressman from California, fought for the passage of the act for more than a decade. When the act finally got through Congress, the president issued the following statement explaining the significance, saying, "This legislation springs from one of our most essential principles. A democracy works best when the people have all the information that the security of the nation permits. No one should be able to pull the curtains of secrecy around decisions which can be revealed without injury to the public interest." Since the passage of the act, the process of requesting records has come to be known by the acronym FOIA. FOIA can be a powerful tool in the hands of working people. For example, consumer advocacy groups can submit a FOIA request for information about a product safety record, or citizens can submit a FOIA request to learn about the employment practices of companies with government contracts. Unfortunately, some FOIA requests get bogged down in red tape. In some cases, battles over the requests have gone all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Over the past 5 decades, there have been several amendments. Some have reduced access to federal documents, while others have made information more accessible. There are ongoing tensions between keeping state secrets and having a tool for transparency and accountability for government. States have their own Freedom of Information laws. Despite the red tape, the Freedom of Information Act was an important step forward for U.S. citizens to be informed citizens.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So I want to finish off today with a story that my friend Eric Loomis, labor historian, did an extensive Twitter thread on. You know, as we're talking about returning to the days of Lochner and government not being able to infringe on liberty of contract and basically government not being able to have maximum hour laws, minimum wage laws, safe working conditions, workers' comp becomes part of this. And he goes through the story of this guy named Charles Weaver, who lost an eye when a crowbar hit him in the face at work. He was an auto worker. And he basically got screwed over by what was the new workers' compensation system because, well, again, as we allow government to be controlled by the wealthy, by the powerful, by corporate interests, it's always the little guy who gets screwed over. And understand, much like the National Labor Relations Act, the original workers' comp system was a compromise. And that compromise meant working people were going to get screwed. It was kind of a peace treaty, if you will. But the original comp system was very much a pro-industry reform, where before this, if you were an injured worker, you had to go to court and you had to sue. Well, what would happen is you would consistently lose in the court, because at the time, this idea of free contract, of liberty of contract, favored employers. You know, the judges would claim, you know, back to the 1830s, that individuals, that workers and employers, they entered into an equal contract, that they were on equal plans. Never mind poverty, never mind the need of workers to be able to, you know, put a roof over their head, food on the table, you know, take care of their kids. Never mind those things, but they were equal. You have the right to not take the job. And in a work environment where all the jobs were crummy, where they were all dangerous, where things were bad, workers didn't have the kind of power that we kind of assume, that we take for granted today. And it's because we've been able to pass laws that says, no, we're not going to allow you to, you know, to work people, you know, 24 hours a day. No, we're not going to, without paying them a reasonable wage. No, we're not going to let you hire people for a buck an hour. And I fear we're heading back to the days where this kind of stuff would happen. So he tells this story of Charles Weaver, who not only lost that eye, this is the eye that he lost the suit over. He lost both his eyes because, you know, he lost the first one in another job setting, but had to go back to work somewhere because there was no social safety net. There was nothing for him, so he had to go back to work. And they made, you know, the comp system, you know, so, well, cheap that employers were okay with it, because they knew they weren't going to have to pay legal fees. They knew they weren't going to have to risk losing, because there was a point where juries were starting to go, wait a second, I now know people who have gotten injured. Maybe we start letting them win occasionally. So the pendulum was swinging back towards the sides of workers, and well, no. And we're in a moment, you know, to highlight Kevin Roberts' statement, this is the second American Revolution. That a second American Revolution is about undoing the 20th century and returning us to the desperation of the Charles Weavers, returning us to an era where working people didn't have the power that we now take for granted. And this is the part that I think is, you know, incredibly important. We have no idea what it is going to look like when conservatives get what they want. I've been saying for years, they're telling us what they want. They want a society free of any social safety net, free of any regulation, where the rich, the powerful, the corporate interests have all the power, and you, me, and everyone else who desperate enough, hungry enough to work for poverty wages in deplorable conditions, it's our freedom. It's our right. And that shall be the natural order. Laissez-faire capitalism, uninfringed, is what they want for us. And the weird thing is they've done such a great job of constantly hammering that. I have working people who tell me that's what they want. And it's always interesting to me that, you know, I think back to when I was doing union organizing, and there was a guy who was dead set against the union, worked for this machine company for, you know, like 20 years. And he got injured. A piece of metal, you know, he was working on. He ended up, I forget how he first got injured, but he came back to work after some time. Then he got injured again. A piece of metal flew off a lathe that he wasn't even working on, cut his arm, and they fired him. And he was, but I've been a loyal employee. It was only then that he realized the power of a union that would have fought for him. The power of some regulation to ensure that he has some rights. It was only then, when it affected him, did he then go, maybe it's a bad idea to give the employers all the rights. We're in for an interesting ride these next couple of decades. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@therickssmithshow.com.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.